Good morning. We have four appeals to hear this morning. Council, we're familiar with your cases. We've read your briefs, the authority cited in your briefs, at least portions of the record. So in the limited time that you have this morning, you should feel free to get straight to the heart of your argument, whatever it is that you want us to focus most on. Please pay attention to the red light. If it shines, it is time to stop. But if you're answering a question from the court, you can, of course, finish your answer and won't lose rebuttal time if that's something that you have. We'll begin this morning with Parnell versus the United States. Ms. Copeland.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Amy Lee Copeland. I represent Stuart Parnell. Mr. Parnell's brother and co-defendant, Michael Parnell, proceeds on the same certificate of appealability and is represented by Elliot Harding, who's up next. In this case, pretrial publicity and community sentiment turned the government's case against Stuart Parnell from a documents case into a death case. All four factors of Skilling versus United States compel a presumption of prejudice arising from the trial of this case in the Albany Division of the Middle District of Georgia. Stuart Parnell simply did not receive a fair trial before a fair and impartial jury. The showing of presumed jury prejudice, at least in this case, operates to establish both prongs of an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. Strickland cautioned courts to remember practical considerations, the most important of which and the main focus of which is the fundamental fairness of the proceedings. As Strickland wrote, is the result of a particular proceeding unreliable because of a breakdown in the adversarial process that our system counts on to produce just results?
Can we start at the presumed prejudice part?
Yes.
So I'm skipping over Skilling factors for the moment, and just I'm assuming you've gotten there, and your argument is, well, that presumes prejudice, and that means that I win. We seem to have suggested in Purvis, and it seems to me that the Supreme Court in Weaver agreed with a largely of what we said. It had a slightly different issue, but largely what we said. But in Purvis, one of our colleagues who's sitting on the bench wrote very eloquently that there are really only three situations in which we presume prejudice in the context of a Strickland ineffective assistance of counsel claim. I won't list all three of them, but they're not this one. And as regarding everything else, including for structural errors, even assuming this would be a structural error, and I have my doubts, but even assuming it is, we still don't presume prejudice because otherwise it would encourage defendants to sit on their hands and hide issues and then bring them back later on for essentially a second bite in an appeal. How do we respond to that?
Sure. So several responses there. Number one, Weaver was very much limited to the facts of its case, as you're well aware.
Well, so I'm talking about Purvis, not Weaver.
Okay.
Weaver, in my mind, is consistent with the part of what we said in Purvis, which is there isn't a different standard for structural error cases, but for the larger point that we don't presume prejudice except for these three things, why would we add this to the list, and how is what's going on here consistent with what you're articulating to us?
Judge, look, we should add this to the list because in the Coleman versus Kemp case, which was the all-day murder case, the court said, listen, even if a defendant has overwhelming of evidence of guilt, he is always entitled to a fair trial before a fair and impartial jury.
Yeah, but all day, you want to talk about distinguishable? How many members of the jury in all day were personal friends of the murder victims?
Your Honor, it was...
That's a question.
Yes, Your Honor, it was most of them. The Seminole County...
So you put the jury controlling interest in the jury. It only takes one to prevent an acquittal, but they had I thought it was three or four, but let's say it was a majority or three or four who literally knew the victims who had been murdered. Now, if that's not presumptive prejudice, of course it is, but it's based on the knowledge of the jurors about the person who was murdered and their affinity towards them.
But, Your Honor, the fundamental proposition that every criminal defendant is entitled to a fair trial before a fair and impartial jury still stands.
But not a perfect one.
Not a perfect one, Judge, but just as three or four members of the jury in all day knew the victim in the case. It turns out in the jury inquiry hearing, three or four members of the jury knew an extrajudicial fact of death. a fact so prejudicial that the defense attorneys argued in a motion in limine that it would encourage a jury to make a decision based on something other than the facts of the case.
I don't understand the government's position on that. I've always thought that the crime, evidence of the crime, included the result of the crime. I mean, I've never heard anybody suggest that if a defendant commits a crime and it results in a death, you'd better not mention the death.
Your Honor, this was a documents case, though, and that was one of the dangers of the pretrial publicity. What folks remembered about the
was a fraud case that resulted in sickness and death.
Your Honor,
it wasn't some, you forgot to disclose to the government this. You cheated on your taxes that.
It was a fraud case that the government said that they had to keep their eye on the ball about letting in unduly prejudicial evidence, and they felt that death would be unduly prejudicial evidence.
We're not bound by that as a matter of discussing Strickland prejudice. I mean, the government's position and view on it and its magnanimity towards you does not bind us for determining what prejudice is with regard to that. If I could, I really would like to go back to my question, because there are lots of jury unfairness issues. In fact, Purvis deals with that. What Purvis says is only where there's these specific issues dealing with counsel and essentially counsel's inability to render any assistance at all. In other words, it affected the Sixth Amendment right in and of itself. Beyond that, we don't, even where there's structural error, even where there's error that you're talking about, we don't presume it when we get to the post-conviction stage, right?
Your Honor, Purvis did say there has to be actual prejudice.
Right.
I understand that.
I just don't know how we get past that for this. And unless we simply say we didn't really need it in Purvis and we can add to that list anything we want to.
These types of errors have to be judged on a case-by-case basis. The Supreme Court is very clear about that, because the genesis of structural errors comes from three different buckets, right? I think this is error that always results in fundamental unfairness of a proceeding, but jury knows.
I'll assume for the moment, I have my doubts, because in CAMPA, where you can overcome, it seems that if you can overcome the error and overcome the presumption, then it isn't so much structural, that's sort of inherently non-structural, but I'll assume it is. I just don't get how we get past Weaver and Purvis that just because an error is structural does not mean that we presume prejudice. In other words, one doesn't flow from the other necessarily.
Right. If you look at Strickland, it has to have a reasonable probability of an outcome on the verdict, right?
Yeah.
Here, though, this is something that if there's not a fair and impartial jury, you're just not going to have a fair trial. And so it would negate any claim based on the fact that you did not receive a fair and impartial jury, because the jury is always stacked against you. And we see this in the case when you go through jury selection.
Right, but what you could say is, but for that, I would have been able to have a different result, or I probably would have had, or a reasonable probability of a different result. Just because the error is difficult to prove doesn't mean that you don't have to prove it. Those aren't, again, one doesn't necessarily flow from the other.
But we are entitled to presumption of prejudice here, Your Honor, simply because of the nature of the pretrial publicity and the community sentiment. When you look at other 11th Circuit cases, too, they talk about what is the standard for change of venue, if you want to take it to just a change of venue issue. Is it reasonable probability that the judge would have granted a motion for change of venue if it had been requested? That's Meeks, that's Candler. Here,
he had said, I'll give you a change of venue. I'm going to transfer you to Atlanta. And the attorneys in your case, three of them with 77 years experience, said the last thing we want to do is get away from a rural jury, which we may do if we move for a change of venue. And that's not based on our experience, more than three quarters of a century of combined experience. That's not good for our client. He has a better chance of acquittal if we stay here. That's what they testified to.
I understand the testimony, but I...
And that's performance problem. Tell me how we're supposed to say that it's outside the wide range of reasonable professional assistance to have those premises and that conclusion carefully considered and the conclusion reached, and that no reasonable attorney could reach that conclusion.
Because, Your Honor, when they heard what this jury had to say, they should have known that all of these thoughts that, you know, everybody in Southwest Georgia knows there's rats and peanuts. That was why they said they wanted to keep it in Albany.
And rural juries don't like the federal government telling them how to grow food.
Don't like them telling them what to do. The assumption that counsel had in trial counsel was that all of the jurors would be on welfare and that they didn't like government overreach was one of the counsels going into it.
One of them, but not the other two.
But when they got into the jury, when they got into voir dire, they heard veneer people say things like, I know there was salmonella spread, and there were some people that had gotten sick, and there were some people that died from it. If these defendants knew what happened, they were just mean and greedy. She said that she was reserved about...
But counsel, the two most extreme examples, and one of the ones you're reading from, were excluded. And as I understand it...
She was not, Your Honor, actually.
Okay.
She was not.
But those that said they knew about the death said that it would not have impacted their verdict during voir dire. And more importantly, as I understand it, more than half the jurors said they had never heard about the case or didn't know anything about it.
60% of the 78 people summoned for jury duty said that they had heard about the case or knew.
Which, so 40% in this rural community that you're talking about is so impacted by this that it affected everybody and knows about this because the industry is centered there, had no idea.
Because the jury talked about it too, Judge. There was the voir dire where this came out, but in the jury inquiry hearing after the...
I understand, but the point is, if we're talking about it should have changed venue up front, the judge would have no idea what happened later on. All they would have, the judge would have, is what happened at the time of voir dire. At the time of voir dire, 40% of the jurors around had no idea anything about this. So how could...
Seven of the ones who were ultimately seated on the jury fell into that group.
Yes, Your Honor, and 11 people told the court that they knew about the deaths, and nothing was done. And the sentiment, you look at the cases, and Rule 21 transfer between divisions, or I'm sorry, between districts, are uniquely suited for what comes out at voir dire. And these attorneys heard statements that veneer people...
So you're saying if the judge had said we're going to Atlanta, that would have been reversible error?
Your Honor, they should have asked, and they didn't ask. They didn't ask for an intra-division.
And you, with the burden of persuasion, proof and persuasion, didn't ask either, you being the attorney representing the defendants. You didn't say, Judge, where will you transfer this?
Your Honor, I'm here on appeal, and, you know, we are before the circuit. I think the best place to have tried this case was Macon, 2 hours away, where none of this pervasive community...
But there's nothing in the record indicating that's where the case would have gone.
There isn't, Your Honor, but an intra-district transfer, you have no right to have a trial in a particular division of a district. And so under Rule 18, an intra-district transfer could have been accomplished easily, and that's what should have been required.
Could have, should have, would have, but you don't get to the would have.
I see my time is up, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay, you've saved 3 minutes for rebuttal, Mr. Walker.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Stuart Walker on behalf of the United States. If this appeal were a cat, there'd be at least two ways to skin it, two approaches the court could take. The first would be to hold that a motion to transfer venue out of the Albany Division in the Middle District would not have succeeded, would have lacked merit, because the failure to pursue an unmeritorious motion does not lead to a finding of deficient performance and relatedly does not prejudice the defendant. That's one way we could approach the case, which is to say no jury prejudice presumption arose in the first place. And even if it did, to Judge Luck's point, it was adequately rebutted by the voir dire process.
Is the better way to do it the way that Judge Carnes asked about, which is on the deficiency prong? Because we sort of, and I don't blame anybody, our questions kind of assumes it or skips over it, but it, Provenzo and Weeks seems to suggest that where counsel testifies, especially experienced counsel testifies in their experience, that a particular area might be beneficial to them, and one could logically understand that being in a community that understands peanuts would be very sympathetic to someone who say, this is how the industry happens and we didn't do anything wrong here, would be a good strategic decision, although not working out in the end.
Absolutely, Your Honor. You took the words right out of my mouth. The second way to approach the case would be to say, even if there was some modicum of merit in the motion, that the petitioner has not overcome the strong presumption that his lawyers discharged their duties toward him in a constitutionally effective way because they made a strategic decision not to move for transfer of venue because they thought it was in the best interest of their client. Now, that rests on a finding of fact that the magistrate judge credited the testimony of the lawyers. That was adopted by the district court, and I don't see any effort on my friend's part to try to disturb that fact finding as clearly erroneous.
Well, here's what I think your opposing counsel may say, and what your opposing counsel may say is because this is a structural error, and I think they do say this, either this your counsel here or the next counsel, because this is a structural error, it really doesn't matter whether there was a strategic reason to do it or not. It's structurally erroneous in and of itself, and for that reason, prejudice flows directly from that. That's as I understand the argument on the other side. So is this the kind of error that you can't strategically make or not on behalf of a client?
We don't think it is, Your Honor.
Why is that?
Even if you assume, well, let me just, if you assume it is, let's just assume it is structural error.
Yes.
The argument, and I understand the same way you do, I think cannot be reconciled with Purvis and with Hollis. So even if that is their argument.
That gets to the prejudice side of it, though, and I think I might agree with you, but I just want to close the loop on the deficiency side. If it is a structural error, do you agree then it isn't one where a strategic decision can be made on behalf of a client? In other words, a lawyer can't say, I'm going to spend lunch break or I'm going to spend the afternoon at the restaurant while the trial goes on for strategic reasons. The lawyer's got to be there, right?
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
So is this, I guess what I'm saying is, assuming this is that kind of error, counsel can't assume it away with strategy, right?
I'm not sure that follows. I mean, if you read the first paragraph of Weaver, okay, this is critical, I think, to understanding how this works. Weaver says this case comes to us on the assumption that there was deficient performance. And in that case, they assumed that the partial courtroom closing was a structural error, and it was all focused on whether to presume Strickland prejudice at the second stage. But the fact that they noted that it came on the assumption that there was deficient performance, I think telegraphs to me that there could be a tactical reason for failing to object to something that is a structural error.
I will say counsel in brief seems to suggest that one way would be client consent, meaning, in other words, if there was a colloquy with the client who knew that it was possible to file a venue motion, understood the ins and outs of it, and decided, no, I want my trial to be here, that would be fine, despite it being a potential structural error, right? So that indicates that there are ways around structural error. There are deficiency parts that we have to look at, right?
I agree with that. So as I was trying to communicate a moment ago, I think the most efficient route for resolving the appeal is to say that they cannot overcome the presumption of adequate representation, and they can't overcome, or they can't show prejudice because of the tactical reasons that were given and credited by the district.
If we go that route, we don't have to find the Skilling factors, and we don't have to decide whether there's presumed prejudice in the situation and how it would apply here, right?
My position is you can assume all of that away. And often that is what the court will do. In Purvis is a classic example of that. I think, Judge Carnes, you said, here are the three things we're going to assume away so we can get right to the heart of the matter. And I think in this case, you could resolve question number one in the COA, whether the trial court erred in finding that there was no presumption of prejudice under Skilling, by assuming that it might have had merit, that there might have been a presumption that wasn't rebutted, but in any event, the testimony of the lawyers was that based on their experience, the best interest of their client was not to pursue that. And that fact finding is reviewed here for clear error, and there's no challenge to it, which leads then to the final consideration, which is what...
Well, let me get back to that for a second. Counsel in their brief seems to suggest that the failure to do a survey or to do anything more than sort of a superficial look at, here's my feeling about the community, I've talked to some local folks and I'm monitoring the newspapers, that's not really enough in order to make an informed decision about, a formed strategic decision about whether to file the motion or not. How do we respond to that?
Well, the response, Your Honor, is this court's cases that say there's an inverse relationship between the amount of investigation that has to be done and the amount of experience a lawyer has in criminal defense work. And here, as Judge Carnes noted, you have an overwhelming number of years of experience. And what I mean by that is not that you can't just shut your eyes and not do anything, but the more experience you have, the less intensive investigation like surveying and that sort of thing you'd have to do. The law lets lawyers make reasonable assumptions based on their experience and what would be worthwhile to pursue. And here, they valued their defense strategy about government overreach and the unsanitary conditions in the facility, they valued that higher than they valued the need to go out and canvass and do community surveys and that sort of thing. And that's exactly the kind of reasonable choice that we expect lawyers to make and don't penalize them for in hindsight. That, I think, is the response to the question about some allegation that they did some insufficient investigation about community passion.
So doesn't, I mean, the sentence in Purvis, maybe you said it and I was making notes on something else, but I haven't heard you say, quote, "The law of this circuit is that an ineffective assistance to counsel claim based on the failure to object to a structural error at trial requires proof of prejudice," meaning Strickland prejudice.
Yes, that's right. I didn't mean to say otherwise.
You didn't say otherwise, you just didn't say. What I'm saying is that's right on point to her argument that this was structural error, and therefore you don't have to do anything but just say structural error, reverse.
Absolutely. That's 100% agree with that. I mean, that's why I was trying to say in response to Judge Luck's question to me, the argument that there's a presumed prejudice can't stand in light of purpose. I mean, there's no way around purpose in our view. And so then if we're taking sort of the second tack that I outlined where we're saying there's a presumption of reasonable representation, it's supported by strategic reasons testified to and credited by the fact finder and not disturbed, not as clearly erroneous, then the final decision is whether that choice was reasonable. And that's, of course, a question of law the court reviews de novo. And what the court's cases say is the more experienced the lawyers who are making the decisions, the less likely it is to be unreasonable.
Does the argument of the petitioners here, the petitioners below, rise and fall on presumed prejudice? In other words, did they make an alternative argument regarding Strickland prejudice as normally understood reasonable probability of a different result?
I don't understand the briefing to make any attempt to show
either
actual Strickland prejudice.
Did they do so below?
No, Your Honor. I don't believe so. I believe they said sort of, we think you should find presumed prejudice, and if you do, we win. We don't have to show anything further, is the way I understood it.
Do you agree that it would be sufficient showing of prejudice if they had, which they didn't, show that the motion would have been granted?
I think that is one way to show prejudice, yes, Your Honor, because
that's all they have to show.
Well, I think the converse is what the cases say is that if there's a showing that it would have lacked merit, then there can be no prejudice. And I'm not sure if maybe it necessarily follows that if it had been granted, there would.
Don't you have to show a reasonable probability of a different result of the outcome of the proceeding? I mean, it's not enough that you just get a jury somewhere else. You have to show that jury would have not been tainted and...
That's right, and I didn't mean the implication of my answer to suggest otherwise.
Okay.
Strickland prejudice from a trial error is you have to show.
I honestly don't know the answer, but that would seem, that's as I understand Strickland prejudice. Maybe I'm wrong.
I don't think there's a different variant of Strickland prejudice for something like this. I think it is a reasonable probability that the outcome of the proceeding would have been different. That's what Strickland says, and all that's shot through the case law in this area. All I meant is that there is a strand of this court's cases where the failure is, where the alleged deficiency is the failure to pursue a motion, then the court says, well, it rises and falls on the merit of that motion as to both deficient performance and prejudice. That's all I was trying to suggest.
In other words, step one would be the motion would have to be granted, but you'd still have to show step two.
That would be, yes, that would be a necessary condition, but not sufficient, is the way I would describe it.
In Meeks v. Moore, we said that the required showing on prejudice is whether there was, quote, "a reasonable probability the trial court would have granted a motion for change of venue if it had been brought." Now, we rejected an IAC claim in that case, so that's probably dicta, but at least that is a statement that disagrees with your position.
Your Honor, I'm not sure I would agree that it disagrees with my position. I think it's consistent with what I'm saying, in line with what Judge Lake was saying. Maybe that's a first step you'd have to show, right? That the motion would have had merit to establish prejudice.
We didn't say that's a first step.
Well, no, Your Honor. You did, but I think probably because if the motion didn't have merit, you wouldn't have then had to evaluate would there have been a reasonable probability the proceeding would have been different. In other words, it didn't say it, but I'm not sure it needed to say it. So I'm not certain it's inconsistent with the position that we're taking here. I'm happy to address any other questions the panel might have. Otherwise, I think we've extensively covered.
I have a question, and I've held it to the end so as not to use up your time on things that may affect the result of this argument. But where did the government's concession that you couldn't mention deaths caused by the criminal conduct of the defendants come from?
Your Honor, that was in response to a motion in limine filed by...
I know how it came from procedurally. I mean, did DOJ call you, or were you the trial counsel?
No, Your Honor. I was not even in the office at the time this case was.
Then your response can be, I don't know, I couldn't believe it when I read it.
It could be, Your Honor. I would add one thing, though. I just do want to make this clear, because I think it's important to underscore. They are treating that concession that there would be prejudice at the mention of death. They're conflating two different kinds of prejudice. I think what the government's position was that under a 403 analysis, we didn't need to prove death to prove the case. We were going to show injuries, and that was enough, and we didn't see cluttering up the case.
That's not a 403 analysis. That's an analysis that we won't do the 403 way. We won't get to it. We're being cautious about it.
Absolutely.
That, it just... I learned something on good days every day, but that is just, that's like saying that somebody who was drunk or stoned out of their mind and ran through a crosswalk at 8:30 in the morning and ran over and killed three kids, you can get them for driving under the influence, and that's what the charge is, but you can't mention what happened when they got to the crosswalk. That's just strange to me, I won't take up any more of anybody's time because it's not...
Brother Carnes is upset the government wasn't aggressive enough. The easiest way to resolve this case is to say no deficient performance,
yes,
that these lawyers made a reasonable strategic decision, that they were better with this rural Georgia venue where people understand the peanut industry than going somewhere else.
That's right, Your Honor.
If you do that, that resolves the case, doesn't it?
That's on the finding of fact, if you're clear.
Very experienced counsel who came to that conclusion, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
At least what we need to, there's less than that can be said, which is we can't say no competent attorney could have reached that position.
That's right.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's right. Thank you. We would respectfully ask that the court affirm the denial of Mr. Parnell's 2255 motion.
Thank you. Ms. Copeland.
Very briefly, to address the deficient performance concern, I believe it was outside the scope of the certificate of authority for me to attack the factual finding of the deficient performance. I mentioned part of it in the brief. I did find one Supreme Court case, McCoy versus Louisiana, 138 Supreme Court, 1500, 2018. It was phrased as an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. Trial counsel over defendant's objection conceded guilt in a murder case because he said strategically that would give him a better chance of trying to avoid the death penalty. The Supreme Court actually plucked the case out of the ineffective assistance of counsel rubric because it involved the client's autonomy, not the client's not counsel's competence, and said that this was a structural error. Really,
I'm sorry, what did the fellow do wrong? Well, I missed that.
Yes, Your Honor. Trial counsel had a conversation with his client, Mr. McCoy. Mr. McCoy said, I didn't murder my family. I don't give you permission to say that I murdered my family.
Of course. That's just...
Right. Yes, Your Honor. But there had been a question whether the deficient performance prong is ever discarded in ineffective assistance.
They slap labels on things because it's easier than analyzing it. But the reason that was error, we don't want to talk about the details beyond the fact that he basically played him guilty in front of the jury, is because it is so outrageous and so contrary to the idea that the defendant has a right to determine certain aspects of a trial. You can't plead a defendant guilty. You can't waive a jury on a defendant. And there's the third item, I think, that has to do with
stand.
Yeah, you can't refuse to let him take the stand, even if he's going to lie through his teeth. You just sit down and let him narrate his own lies. That's what that's about. But there's nothing here that says you can't make a decision on a change of venue.
Your Honor, the reason I brought the case up was simply this. I am very familiar with what defense attorneys can't decide to do for their clients. There had simply been a question, was the ineffective assistance, the deficient performance ever kind of plucked out and viewed separately? I was just candid with the court. That's all, Judge. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Copeland. We appreciate it. And we'll move to the other Parnell case.